Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's done nothing this week except move some logs about. He's going to try and get 5 minutes of stand-up out of that. It's Richard Herring! Oh, you're exactly equal to last week's audience. Exactly equal. It was exactly, just not quite loud enough clapping for my liking. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I was talking to Steve Austin the other day. Not the wrestler. Not the wrestler, the $6 million man. And he was with Steve Austin, the wrestler. And Steve Austin calls it Relastapa, so... Not going to tell you which one. Pathetic. Literally, I've been working all week. I've got nothing for you. All that's interesting to me is that, and it's not even interesting, and it will offend some people. We have a log fire in our house. It's beautiful, but apparently you're not meant to do that anymore, right? Because of political correctness gone mad. And we had a big load of logs delivered, and I spent about 2 days moving logs from the road into my garage and then from my garage into the wood store. And it's the most manly I've felt for a long time. It's like, you know, lumberjacks are all fine. They chop down the trees, but can they carry the logs in a washing basket? That's all I had. And chuck them into the wood store. It's quite satisfying to try and throw them into the gaps. It's like Tetris. No. Yeah, I've changed, and I have changed since I moved to the countryside. Let's meet some of the audience. It's all familiar people. You're not that familiar. I don't know if my... Is this going to stretch? No. Hello, what's your name?
Jess.
Jess, how are you doing, Jess? Good. What do you do for a living, Jess? Are you working... Like, let me guess. You don't work in IT, I'm telling you that right now. No? All close. I was going to say you work in publishing. What do you do?
Financial crime technology.
You do what? You work in technology.
Yeah.
That's IT, right? That's what the T... I don't know what the I stands for. I don't even know what IT stands for, but this, the T bit is technology, right? I do technology. Is that what it stands for? What kind of technology are you working alongside? Your friend finds it very funny. Did you work in the same thing? Oh, did you?
You'll never be able to explain this.
No, we've got time. I've got no material. We've got time. We can find out about jobs, other people's jobs. Do you move logs around at all? No. In your spare time? Have you got a real log fire at your house? No. See, that's why you should be a comedian, not in technology, because I've got a very old fireplace. Gas and treating's bad as well, though, isn't it? Dave, so you know what am I meant to do? How am I meant to heat my house?
Solar power.
I'm not allowed to put solar panels on the roof of my house. It's grade 2 listed.
Put it in the garden.
I haven't got a very big garden.
There's a field nearby.
I think the farm might be annoyed if I put solar panels all over it. You never know. Good. Well, I'm glad you're here. What attracted you to come to see Rahulastapa today? Is it your fourth time? Wow, that's good, isn't it? It's like a proper normal woman. No offence. You're all lovely. Let's crack on. We've got a fantastic... You don't need me blithering. Very nice to meet you, Jess. Thank you for coming four times. Come again. Got some bad news about next week's show, but let's... I haven't even told the theatre yet, so let's... Let's move on. My guest this week is probably best known for her appearance on Celebrity Antiques Road Trip. That's pretty good, and that's a pretty good one. Will you please welcome the amazing Chaparral Kosandi, ladies and gentlemen? Here she is. Come in.
Hello. It's exciting.
It's very lovely to have you back. I was saying it's over 8 years since you were last on this show.
It is. Do you know, this is the first time I've sat down all day. I'm so happy to be here for all sorts of reasons, but mainly comfort.
It's nice to sit down and say, what have you been doing? Have you been moving logs around? That's all the comedians are doing it.
There's the logs. Yeah. There's the logs and also dog. I have a dog.
Oh, yeah.
And my dog takes up most of my time. And everyone always cuts me slack for missing meetings, being late, because they go, oh, she's a single mum. But really, it's the dog.
The dog. It's a lot of work. I've got a dog.
Okay, let's not have a competition whose dog is more hard work. But I have a crazy golden retriever, field golden retriever, not like a ploddy one that I wanted. I've got a very athletic dog that needs to run about 2 hours a day.
Right.
And then she likes to find the most disgusting puddle that has been pooed in and peed in by every other animal in West London. And she likes to roll in that.
Yeah.
And then I have to go home and wash her. And then I've got to wash all my kitchen because then she shakes. So when people say, oh, Shappy, your career really depended on this meeting and you didn't turn up, I say, I was scrubbing my kitchen.
Scrubbing my kitchen, scrubbing shit off my dog.
I was scrubbing shit off my dog, yeah. So it's so nice to be here.
Good.
Without the dog.
What's that? Is the dog just running around outside in Leicester Square on its own?
Just doing loops. Loops of Leicester Square.
There's some good shit out there, I tell you. Oh. That's mainly human, unfortunately.
Really, and then in lockdown, I got a another dog.
Okay.
Because I didn't know that I had ADHD. I thought I really wanted a dog, another dog. But it turned out that when lockdown happened and all the kerfuffle of this career went, I couldn't cope with the peace. So I think my brain, when I say I think, this is what my therapist told me, your brain thought of the most chaotic thing you could possibly do, and that is to bring an adult street dog that was completely feral and part shepherd into your home and just see what triggers it.
Yeah.
Over a period of time. So we got Benji and Benji and Taylor, my golden retriever that I've had since I was a pup. So Taylor's my...
Since you were a pup.
Well, no, she's my biological dog. Right? Okay. So I've had her... They would just fight all day long, and my time in lockdown was spent just getting between these two fighting dogs.
Okay.
And my children were running around barefoot and hungry, and everyone's like, oh my God, you must be reading so many books. Fuck off. So now there's a lovely couple down the road who fell in love with Benji, and they said, oh, can we walk your lovely Benji dog? So they kept walking the dog, and after a couple of months they said, we love him so much that we've put our name down to rescue a dog as well. And I was like, why didn't you rescue me? I wanted to go and live in their house, and they said no. But they said, we will have Benji to live in our house. So now he lives five doors down.
That's nice. So you still see him?
I still have to walk him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I said, I love him so much, I'll still walk him. And they're like, great. And I'm like, really? I mean, some time's gone by, that love wanes. I hope they don't listen to this.
That happened to me too. They probably do. Everyone does. And if they don't, someone will tell them about it.
Yeah.
I might just go five doors from your house and tell people in both directions.
And then the other dog, right, yeah. Taylor, because Taylor was my first dog, and everyone said you've got to crate train dogs. So I bought a crate, and you're meant to make it all nice, like, you know, their first home. So I got a picture of her mum. And then what I did was I went upstairs and I put the dog in the crate, and everyone said, don't take it to bed with you because you'll be building a rod for your own back.
Yeah.
So I went to bed, the dog starts crying, and I can't handle that because I'm a mammal, so I come and soothe the dog. I go up, yo-yo. I'm up and down like a yo-yo, but I didn't take it to bed. What I ended up doing, I took my duvet downstairs and I slept next to the dog for 6 weeks. So now the dog started creeping up to my room once I fell asleep, so she sleeps on my bed and I'm fully crate trained. So it's... That's what I spent all my time doing, dog care.
Do you think the picture of the dog in the crate is your mother, though? That's the if you've got to that point.
That's where I love her. We look alike.
So is everything okay, Shappy? Are you all right?
I am okay, thank you. I'm very okay.
It's lovely to see you again. Anyway, so that's the weird thing about doing this podcast. It has been going for so long. It can't have been that long since Shappy was on, but...
Yeah, my daughter's eight, and she was just born when I came on here.
Right.
Well, she wasn't just born.
Yeah,
I didn't
that would
come
be amazing.
Yeah, I didn't come in from
I
hospital.
Did insist it was out before you came on, so just get that thing out of you, then you can come on.
Yeah. It's like, she's so hardworking. She's still got a head dangling out of her. But anyway, yeah, she's eight now, so she's ready to leave home.
Are you able to see her with all the dogs running around in the house and the
yes? Now that there's only one dog again, the children are fed again. But I found it's really hard. I don't know what your children are like, but mine are much cleverer than me, and they both love maths.
Right.
And I got a D for my maths GCSE, and I retook it and got an E. At the beginning of lockdown, my daughter was six. And I was helping her with her maths homework, and my son, who was 13, sat opposite her, and I was trying to do the sum, and I did it wrong, a six-year-old's work. Yeah. I did wrong, and she said, and I'm all stressed out about it because I'm like the provider and the teacher now as well as the dog handler. And then I just went, no, it's right, I know it. You know that way you speak to your children when no one else can hear you? I know it's right. And my boy was just gently saying, Mummy, she's right. Vivi's right. The answer's four, not six. I cried and just left them to it, really.
Yeah.
I left the older boy to teach the littler one.
That's nice if you got that. I don't have an older child, so I have to teach. I did have to do some of the homeschooling. And the second lockdown, it was much, much harder. I think that we just had to do more stuff in the second lockdown. But it was like when my dad tried to teach me to drive. We had one lesson and I just shouted at him.
Yeah.
It was like that again.
You just got in the car and screamed at each other.
I know how to do it. I don't know how to do it.
There's something revolting about your parents teaching you something you're beyond the age of seven.
Yeah.
It's like disgusting, the fact that they exist, let alone the fact they... My son is horrified that there are some things that I know that he doesn't know. So he tries to... I feel like that woman in Fawlty Towers. He's very clever. But probably need forensic knowledge of Fawlty Towers, which I assume a comedy audience would. So he lays traps for me. To catch me out with things. Like if I've corrected him on something, he'll stew on it, and then a few days later, he'll say, "So, Mummy, when was Disraeli Prime Minister?" And I'm like, "Oh my God, Disraeli! He was well. We moved to England in the 70s, and I'm pretty sure that it was Callaghan then. And after Callaghan, it was Thatcher. So was Disraeli in the 20s? And is this a trick question?" So I said, I took a gamble. I thought Disraeli was the 60s, and my boy just went, "The 60s." I was like, "Yes." They went, "You're right, Mummy. Which 60s? The 60s before." It was the 1860s, Mum. You know that, Richard, because you're clever. But I had ADHD. I didn't pay attention in school. I just counted things in my head.
Well, my daughter's convinced my daughter's only six, and she's convinced she knows more than me about everything.
She probably
and that
does.
I'm stupid. And she's just made that decision herself. And she'll go to her mum to ask for anything. And she won't. But I do find her homework quite confusing, so...
Well, they learn things differently now.
They do.
Who was it they said, is it Mark Twain? Isn't every quote attributed to Mark Twain? That the 14-year-old looks at his dad and says, "God, this man's an idiot. He knows nothing." And at 22, he looks at his dad and goes, "Hey, he's learned a thing or two since then." So they'll come back to us, Richard.
They might do. So how have you found out you've got ADHD? And was that's happened during lockdown?
A psychiatrist told me.
Right.
I thought I'd better believe them. It wasn't a surprise to anybody, really, that knows me well. And in lockdown, it became really apparent, because in stand-up, you kind of feel at home with ADHD because, let's face it, everyone has it. I always thought ADHD was something naughty little kids get. I didn't know the hyperactive part of it could be quite quiet. So, like, you're hyper in your head. So I would find stand-up comedy really peaceful, because it lets you just not have to deal with any other fucker, just yourself, because everything else is quite bewildering. And also I used to over-talk, like, just babble, like, for ages. Like, that part of me is completely changed. Chilled out now. And also just at school and stuff, it was really hard. School was so hard. Like, I knew I wasn't thick, but I just kept not getting anything done. And then I saw... And in lockdown, anyway, so this job went, all the chaos went that normally I just, you know, thrive in. Well, not thrive, really. A lot of it was really horribly damaging, but let's move on from that. And I had to go and see somebody, and the somebody I saw said, "You've got ADHD, no doubt." And then I remembered 5 years ago, I went to a psychiatrist who said I had ADHD, and I was like, "Fuck, that makes sense." And I came out of his place and I forgot all about it. So I saw another psychiatrist recently who heard me talk for an hour and said, "You have got so much ADHD, we're starting you on drugs immediately."
Did you say, "Can you write that down?"
Yes.
On my hand.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I went on medication for it.
Okay.
Which makes that sleepy side of my brain that organises the rest of my brain wake up.
Okay.
And it controls your emotions. But it lets you take a step back before you react to things. Whereas I would always just react and then think about it later and go, "Oh, I fucked everything up."
And do you think, as a comedian, because, you know, comedians are people as well, but we are also primarily comedians, is there a part of you that would worry that that would affect your ability to create? Or
No, I would have been a better comedian sooner had I been diagnosed earlier.
Right.
I have been doing Just a Minute on Radio 4 for about 15 years. I've done it so many times, and it's become a joke. It became a joke there that I can never get past 10 seconds, right? Ha ha, let's see how Shafi's beaten her time of 3 seconds. Amazing. I did it a few weeks ago for the first time with my ADHD drugs, a whole minute.
Right.
Without repetition, hesitation, or deviation. Because I could see it, and I've... about to go on tour with a new show called It Was the 90s, and it's the first time I have physically written down my show, and it's the first time that I've gone back to it after a preview and pored over it and had the focus to really structure a show. And I'm like, I can't believe I haven't done this before. It's so much better. You know, I'm taking my career seriously. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I'd be like, that'll do. And then, oh, I better work on it, but I can't because I've got a, all the other things, the crazy stuff that people who have ADHD will know, but we don't want to bore everyone else.
No, it isn't boring. It's always very interesting. And it's, well, I'm glad that's... It's kind of strange that it's... Well, I suppose it was diagnosed before, but it's sort of strange that it's taken like so long for it to be recognised.
Well, yeah, because it late diagnosis in women is rife because women are... See, I hate that term, multitasking. Women are multitaskers. You're not meant to be a multitasker. You're hammering yourself into the ground. That's not a thing to aspire to do. We're meant to be multitaskers. We're meant to be ditzy, scatty. So like, oh no, what's Shappy like? She's just like, you know, done something really awful. She's so funny. Such a liability. And that's sort of attributed to women more than men, I think, being chaotic. And so we're not diagnosed as often, and then when you hit perimenopausal, you go proper batshit. And you think, oh God, I better sort this side of things out.
Good. Well, I'm glad you're sorting it out. That's fantastic.
Thank you very much.
Let's briefly, I know you all have talked about this a lot, but you've changed your performing name and your writing name. Well, not changed it, you've changed it back to your actual name.
Yeah.
So your birth name.
Yes.
Of Shaparak. So yes. You've been Shappy as long as I've known you. You decided to be Shappy when did you initially decide to be Shappy? Was that a showbiz decision or was that a school decision?
No, it was in 1990 when I left school and I went to A-level college and I had a horrid time at school. And partly because of my name, partly because I couldn't write or do maths. I had all the names as a kid. Shaparak was shit attack, shark attack, shabaranks, shipwreck, shack attack, all of those things. And I hated it. Yeah. Every time they read out the register, there'd be a volley of like giggling and it made me sad. So I changed it to Shappy when I went to A-level college. I registered as Shappy and I became Shappy and I did gigs and a career as Shappy, and I just got a bit older. And Shappy just sounds like the name you'd give a cavapoo. It just doesn't suit a nearly 50-year-old woman. And it just made me think, like, why I changed it. And it was because I was teased. I always loved my name. It means butterfly, right? And then I was really inspired by Thandi Newton reclaiming her W. Mm-hmm. And, like, Bukayo Saka and Raheem Sterling grew up in the same area that I grew up in. It wouldn't occur to either of them to anglicise their name or make it easier for people to pronounce. So I went to Shaparak and now I've made life really difficult for everyone who knows me. It's really fucking awkward. I should have done it years ago, but I didn't. And people tiptoe around me because we are so conscious about misidentifying people at the moment.
Yeah.
And bless you, God bless you, white people. when white people, you are good, you count. And when they find out my name's changed, I know that you feel that if you mispronounce it or forget to call me Shaparak, you'll feel like big fat racist. And that's not what it is at all. And I'm happy for everyone to call me Shappy. And now I don't really know what to do. I kind of think Shappy was a lot easier for everyone. I think I made my point.
But it's a good point, and I think what you said about the footballers, that you know, it has changed, doesn't it?
Because we've moved on as a culture. We've moved forward. So
it was, you know, it was a weird thing, and I suppose it happened happened in America as well, didn't it? With a lot of people anglicising their names, just like a lot of people in show business as well, to make
Freddie Mercury.
Yeah.
He was the original Iranian he's not Iranian, I claim him, but he's Zoroastrian, origin Iranian. But he was Farrokh Bulsara.
Yes.
Which isn't quite as rock.
But it would be, you know, I don't know, maybe it would be. I think if people just know, if they know you as one name, then it is, you know. I don't know. It's sort of interesting that I think things have changed enough that the going back makes absolute sense.
Yeah, it does. And I feel a little bit like, that sounds really wanky, but before my time. Because if it was today, I would totally be Sharp Aleck from the get-go. And yeah. I'd have a great time watching people mispronounce it. But I mispronounce names all the time myself. Yeah. All the time. It took me ages to, I don't know if it's a dyslexic thing, but Acaster absolutely foxed me when I sort of read it and had to compare him. Acaster, it just didn't work in my brain for ages. I'd be one of those people that compares that would say the name so fast while the audience was applauding.
Right.
So yes. No one saw the hideous mess that I'd made of someone's lovely name. So.
I guess it's, but you know, it's a thing because I worry about that a lot with a lot of guests and a lot of guests that names aren't necessarily that tricky. I do worry that Louise Wenner was on, then I got right at the end of the podcast, I called her Louise Wiener, and she said actually that it is Louise Wiener, really, but she's changed it to Wenner because of a bit living, going to America, and you can't be called Wiener in America. And I think I remember that because I think she originally did go by it. But you don't want to be, it's sort of impolite, isn't it, to get someone's name wrong, but if you've never met them before, never talked to them or never asked them. So it's only weird if I said, so how do I pronounce that? And you went, I'm not, how dare you not know how to pronounce a word you've not seen before? How dare you? Go and learn how to pronounce it.
Poetic Farsi word. How do they not teach you that at your university?
But the more you focus on, you know, like I will look, some names I've like looked up, you know, I've gone to other podcasts to check how other people have done it. And then the more you're focusing on it, then you're much more likely to fuck it up when you come to introduce them onto stage.
Yeah, and also like, do you remember in the 80s and 90s, Siobhan? The name Siobhan would get us all in a tiz. Irish people. No one talks about how much Irish people suffered at the hands of English people pronouncing their names. So that's a... well, the very least of the worries they had, I'll be honest, but... I didn't want to diminish their struggle.
Oh, I think the Irish, though, have deliberately spelt some of those names like that to...
to fuck you
up. Just to fuck us up.
Do you like how I said to fuck you lot? Because mostly I'm like, I'm as British as the rest of you, but when it comes to the Irish, I'm like, yeah, you lot fuck them up.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So let's talk about your stand-up show, which have you started it?
Starting it next week.
Yeah.
So I did my last preview last night.
Okay, and so what is it? That was the night. It was the 90s.
It was, yeah.
So what was the 90s? It's about you in the 90s.
It's pronounced. It was the 90s. Okay. That's how it's pronounced.
Okay.
So it's all the stuff that we thought was normal in the 90s you look back and go, what the living fuck were we doing? Can we swear on this?
Yeah.
What the fucking fuck? it's massively about the Ladakh culture, and it's massively about having no boundaries and having no notion of self-care in the 90s. I never deliberately went to bed in the 90s. Like, sleep was something that just happened to your body from time to time. And then I started on the comedy circuit, which back then wasn't as all nice and slick and professional as it is now. It was really punk, wasn't it? And it was grotty and grimy, and you just drank until either you got some kind of career or you died, right? And it was no one questioned how unhealthy it was. And self-care was like having, I'm trying to look at someone that might relate, was having a Barocca, I'll take the gamble, and having a little rummage around afterwards to check to see if you've left your condom up your twat. So that was looking after yourself. And you went out, like, now our generation sort of say things like, it's such a shame that the younger people do internet dating, because we used to go out on the pub, we used to do it face to face, and now they're just like basing it on looks. It's so reductive. At least they're basing it on something. I'm going to tell you, right? In the 90s, I shagged someone because I liked the way he said the word haberdashery. And then, I might ask you to edit this bit out later, I slept with somebody because a friend of mine told me that he was the lead singer of the Divine Comedy, and he wasn't. So that was the 90s.
Yeah.
And you didn't go out and have a drink in the hope that you'd meet someone you fancied. You went out and you drank until you fancied someone. And we never questioned it. And the Ladakh culture, right? So a lot of younger people don't know what the Ladakh culture was. It was, we thought feminism was emulating the behaviour of the worst behaved men. So it was matching the boys pint for pint, and never showing any kind of vulnerability. So you were never, even with your closest friends, allowed to say that one night stand was really fucked up. And but they were, because I didn't understand one night stands were called that for a reason. I used to wake up in the morning with some bloke that I'd met, wait for him to wake up, and then I'd suggest a picnic. Can you imagine that, Richard, in the 90s? Some bird you picked up. Look at me with my 90s lingo. I want to put something to bed with you. Is that the right? Sorry.
I'm interested.
I've wanted to talk to you about this for ages. I probably should have done it off stage. But, by the way, Richard, this is
being streamed live, by the way.
This is nothing bad, is it? Yeah. Excellent news. So, it's nothing like that. You would never have talked to me in the 90s. You're kidding me. When I was in the 90s, I never watched telly, ever. I was always out. I live in a shitty bedsit. I had no reason to stay in and watch telly. So now I'm catching up on 90s telly. I'm watching Black Books for the first time with my son. It's really good. Have you seen it? And Spaced, I'm watching now. So I never saw your programme. So in the 90s, I knew people that knew you, and we'd go out somewhere and they'd go, oh, God, that's Richard Herring. And I was like, oh, my goodness, it's Richard Herring. And I didn't know who he was. But I pretend I knew who he was. So fast forward millions of years later, and I do a show called The Moon on a Stick.
Yeah.
And so many people messaged me going, oh, my God, you've nicked that. You've nicked that from Lee and Herring, and I didn't know what anyone was talking about. But then I saw, and I was like, oh, fuck, because that was a catchphrase of yours. I didn't nick it off you. I nicked it off of Carla, the rapper.
Right.
Because I met a Carla, the rapper, on Newsnight, rock and roll. And we really got on, and him and his girlfriend spent some time just having dinners, but then they stopped calling me because I just kept talking about my divorce. I lost a lot of friends around then. And bless his heart, he was only about 24 at the time, and I kept droning on about my divorce. Maybe I should have tried harder. I just was so busy with work. And he put his cutlery down, and he went, look, you wanted a career and a baby. You didn't want the moon on a stick. And I went, that's the title of my show. And then I got accused of nicking it off you guys.
But, you know, we didn't originate the phrase, so you're entirely...
But people on Twitter were so mean to me about it. And I explained that Akala story so many times. But yeah. Trolls don't care.
Did he go, moon on a stick? Like, said if he did, he got it from us. Did he go...
He's actually sampled that, his next record.
It's you.
That's so visual.
Yeah, that was me licking this. It was Stewie wanted the moon on a stick. You know, to be honest, you know, you could have been watched a TV a lot in the 1990s and still not been aware of So I don't think we can take.
No, you were the cool kids.
We were so cool.
You still are cool.
Yeah, we still are.
For a dad.
Yeah. Pretty cool. The new book's great.
Thank you for reading it.
It's okay. You read it to me on my audiobook.
Oh, fabulous.
That's what I like.
What were you doing while you listened to the audiobook?
Oh, you don't want to know. I was mainly walking my dog. That's how you mainly walk my dog, or sometimes when I'm running. You're doing a lot of running, and I'm doing a half marathon. You've just done a half marathon.
I have just done a half marathon, yes.
But let's talk about the book.
Yes.
So it's called Kissing Emma, and it's I listened to it before I then read about it, so I didn't know it was based on the life of Emma Hamilton.
Very loosely.
Right. Okay.
Very loosely.
I didn't know much about Emma Hamilton, who was Nelson's. Was she his mistress or his wife?
She was the love of his life.
Right.
His wife didn't divorce him, so he couldn't marry Emma.
Okay.
And she... So my interest in Emma Hamilton, I did a whole show about her. I wish I could remember some of the jokes, but I can't remember. But loads of jokes. So she was the love of Horatio Nelson's life, and she was also really famous because she was the muse of Romney. So people would come from miles around to see portraits of Emma Hamilton. But she came from a family where... She had no dad, and her options were to either find men to, you know, help her in life or die of destitution. So she was beautiful and intelligent and witty, and she was very young, and she went out with various sort of minor aristocratic men, and eventually was gifted to Lord Hamilton in Naples. This Lord Hamilton's nephew went out with her, and then he thought, oh, fuck, I can't marry her because she's got no money. You know that thing about they've got a title, so they need a woman with money. So he just sent her to his uncle, his elderly uncle, and said, a sweeter, cleaner bedfellow you'll never know. And she was like 18 and living with this 50-something-year-old bloke. But anyway, she made the best of it. And... she ended up hanging out with royalty, and she met Nelson, and they fell deeply, deeply, deeply in love. And I found some of the letters that he wrote her when he was at sea, and he'd write things like, I haven't cut my toenails so that when I return, my love will do them for me. Like, that was sort of romance over Horatio Nelson. And then when I researched her as an adult, I found out that she wasn't, you know, she'd worked in a brothel once, right? So the Victorians, when they came to write Emma's history, really focused on that because they wanted to make Nelson about Trafalgar, and they didn't want this woman to kind of be part of the history. I mean, can you believe writing women out of history? So then I found out that while he was on the HMS Victory and he could see the Spanish fleets, he was about to go and fight the Battle of Trafalgar, he changed his will. He wrote a little codicil in his will, and he said, should I die in battle, the one thing I ask of my king and country is that they look after Emma Hamilton and our daughter, our adopted daughter, Horatia. So they couldn't say that she was the real daughter because they weren't married. So that's like me having a kid and calling her Chapeau. But that was his final wish,
right.
Richard.
Yeah.
And not only did they not honour it... They allowed Emma Hamilton to end up in a debtor's prison. She ended up a derelict alcoholic in Calais, a bit like me in the 90s. They turned her into me in the 90s without getting her out of the shit. And she ended up dying of liver cirrhosis. I love where I've taken this chat. When I was writing Emma Hamilton, Kissing Emma, I had an opportunity to see, like, if you had a girl of a similar background today, working class, that had parents who don't have the cultural capital to navigate her through a big comprehensive school. I absolutely based the school on the school I went to. How can she kind of get out of what is expected of her in life? Yeah. You know, how can she protect herself from predatory men in the way that Emma Hamilton couldn't? And so it's a right laugh, my book.
Well, you know, it's not a comedy, no. but it's but it's brilliantly written, and it's really interesting to see comedians making the transition into not writing novels, either comic novels or not comic novels.
Yeah,
and you're very, very good. It's a very good writing. It's gripping as well. It's sort of you don't need to know anything about Emma Hamilton.
Thank you. Do you know? Have you written a novel? I don't know why I said that.
I have not written a novel.
Because novelist was my dream as a child. So I always knew I would write books. But I also knew that I needed to be out drinking. So comedy really fit that. And then once that calmed down, the first love came through. And I'm a much more confident writer than I am a comic. Like if someone like... doesn't like my writing, I go, oh, poor you. But it's that terrible thing to say. But if someone doesn't like my shows, I go, you just saw me on a bad night, dickhead. How dare you come to my show in a bad mood? I just feel like with writing, I can read my book reviews properly and I appreciate them and I want to know what people think and I think it's really interesting. Maybe I just respect... literary reviewers more than I do comedy reviews. But no, I have no self-doubt when it comes to writing. Brilliant. But with comedy, not now that I'm on these pills, I'm a bit overconfident.
You shouldn't have it with comedy either. I think like one of the strongest things you can do against people who don't like your stuff is pity them. I did that on YouTube the other day to someone who didn't like my puppet show, and I was just going, I just sort of feel a bit sorry for you, don't get what this is. And then he just went on and on and got angrier and angrier that I wasn't taking his criticism. He said, this is beneath you, it's not good enough. Go, oh, just pity. I just feel a bit sorry you don't get it.
What is the problem with people who aren't your parents who decide that this is beneath you? It's such a bizarre... People say that to me all the time when they don't like want something else. Oh, that was disappointing.
But it's always about... I think nearly every criticism is about something, either within them or you've hit something within that they're upset about. So some people just don't like rude things, or some people don't like silly things, or, you know. And what I love about comedy is the variety of comedy, and I love all kinds of comedy.
Yeah.
So serious comedy is great. Comedians being serious is great. But comedians just being... My favourite thing is comedians being real, doing something really stupid.
Absolutely.
And you know, and that, so if someone gets I think sometimes people see a room people of laughing at something and go, I don't find this funny, and then they're angry at the thing that everyone else
is
laughing.
Because they have no sense of humour and so they don't understand. It's like if you love music and someone else loves music but a different kind of music to you, you don't think they're a dick. You think, well, that's just a different genre of music that you enjoy because it's all a love of music. And with comedy, it's a very strange thing when people expect you to... The weirdest thing was when people watch a comic and go, well, that was really puerile. Yes! Brilliant! Puerile's the best.
Well, also,
to be more puerile.
As if the comedian wouldn't have... was it? Oh, my goodness. Was I puerile?
When I got my dick out, was that the kind of thing a six-year-old boy would do?
Well, that's good. You know, you were at the Edinburgh Fringe this year.
I was.
2020.
I'll always be one of the ones that were there at 2021. It was such a delight. I went proper old school in Edinburgh this year. I did the thing that you read about comics doing in the 80s, where they write the show on the train and they do it from scratch. And I did it exactly like that. I thought, I want to do a show about the 90s because... whenever I write a book, I go or think of a book, I go to the 90s because that was when I was in my 20s. And because I'm undoing so much damage that I did then, and it's fun to go back. And then I did a week, and every night I went home and I listened to the recording and I wrote down the funny bits like a proper comic. After 20 years, I feel like I've become a proper comic.
That's great. Well, that we know, we did used to, even in the 90s, that was, we often did shows like that. We did some shows completely, you know, day one, see how it goes. And then
in Edinburgh.
Yeah, in Edinburgh.
I know. It's so different. I feel sorry for younger, I don't really feel sorry for younger comics, but it is very different for them now.
It is, but it's different for everyone. My manager was saying for my next show, I should start touring it in March and just make Edinburgh part of the tour. Mm. Whereas I've always, Edinburgh's the point that I go, okay, I'll have a show at the start of Edinburgh and I will still write it over Edinburgh. I'll still change it over Edinburgh. But he thinks I should get to Edinburgh with a show that's finished.
Yeah, I end up doing that just for practical reasons. So because I've accidentally had a summer where I could practice my show in Edinburgh and I am going on tour, and so by next Edinburgh, it will be cooked. And that's not my fault. It's not going to be my fault that my show is going to be kick-ass.
No.
By next August.
But it's probably a good idea, you know. So, like, for all the kind of going, oh, I should... There's this sort of within me, I think, no, it should be a new show and it should be the first... There's no reason that should be the case. You know, you can work up a show and go to Edinburgh and take a really good show.
I think when you're quite long in the tooth, like you and I, we should just sort of enjoy the fact that we don't need to, you know, I don't know, go to Edinburgh and have a fucked up time. I think we can go to Edinburgh and have a nice time now. Yeah. We've earned that.
Maybe. It'll be nice, wouldn't it? It'll be nice. And your dad's your tour driver on this tour,
is he? Is.
That's, how's that working out for you?
Well, my dad... has got really old now. And so my dad's a writer and he's a real party animal, my dad. And he sort of can't really travel much anymore because he's so old. And also he's been such a workaholic all of his life that he's sort of woken up. He was shocked when I told him I was 48. Shocked. And he said, I thought you were about 32. And I was like, no, I'm 48. And like, if you ask my dad, what did Chappie study at university? He wouldn't have a clue. Neither would I, if I'm honest. But so he's feeling very emotional about not having that much time left and wanting to spend more time with me. And I'm absolutely manipulating that feeling. And I suggested, hey, do you remember, Dad, when I was an open spot? Because when I was an open spot, he'd drive me everywhere. I'd had an open spot in Manchester and my dad would drive me. It would be like those days again. But this time, you know, you can sit somewhere warm while you wait for me. And so he goes, brilliant idea. So I've insured him on my car because I won't go in his car. Jeez. And he's going to take me to Bracknell next week.
Wow.
Yeah. And he doesn't come to the shows. He sits in the car and sleeps. And writes poems.
You should get him, like, you know, doing the backstage stuff and lumping stuff around for you.
Yeah, I might decide to be a prop comic just to give him a job.
Are you paying him to drive you around?
No.
Brilliant, it's genius.
He's my dad.
You're saving yourself like 300 quid a gig.
I know. I know. And, yeah, so it's really nice, actually, because I've recently learnt to drive and I never really had, like, conversations... like properly sober with my dad until I started to drive. We went to Costco the other day and we both ended up just weeping because we were just having this really big chat that we'd never really had before, all the way to Costco. And then we bought loads of like toilet paper and cried and got back in the car and he's under a whole load of toothpaste crying and talking about his childhood in Iran and things he never talked about before because he's always busy, busy, busy.
No, it's excellent. You probably get another show out of it.
I hope so.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Costco with my father. Yeah. That wasn't in Fist of Fun, was it?
It wasn't.
Okay.
But not being able to drive, and it was. I thought you still couldn't drive, and I was going to go, you can't even drive, and then you wouldn't have known, but you wouldn't have known what it was about. So I wasn't going to do it. Oh, and look, since you've been on last, you've been on I'm a Celebrity to Get Me Out of Here.
Oh, no.
How was that for you?
That was weird, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was a weird thing to do.
Well, it's a bold choice. It's not always the right choice. Did you feel it was the right choice for you?
It was so neutral for my career.
Really?
It couldn't have been more neutral. It didn't help me. It didn't hinder me.
Okay.
I just went in, sat on a log for 2 weeks talking to Stanley Johnson, and then I quietly left. Nothing bad happened, nothing good happened. I went on it in a... They'd asked me for years, but it's gauche talking about money, isn't it? So let's do it. But the money was never right. I thought, if I get something like that, it's got to be like a year of not touring, right? Yeah. And... reality telly, the money you get differs from show to show. So I'm a Celebrity, you get the same money regardless of where you come in the competition. Right. And it is a competition, right? Yeah. The only way you make more money is if you become an influencer. And I already knew that I don't have what it takes to be an influencer because I was offered £10,000 for one tweet. And my agent said they're going to send you some trainers and they want you to tweet about the trainers and you'll get 10 grand. I was like, fuck me, that's great. So I said, I'll do it. And because I had to square it in my conscience because I was raised a socialist, right? And I'm now trying to earn enough money to become a socialist again. But... but 10 grand for one post, I squared that with my upbringing like that. Anyway, so I'm waiting for running trainers. In through the post comes a pelvic floor trainer.
Okay.
That's what they wanted me to advertise. And that tells you a lot about how I see myself versus how the industry sees me. I'm like, I'm a middle-aged mum that can still cane the occasional half marathon. They saw me as a lady who wets herself when she jumps. So I didn't put two and two together because I'm stupid. And I've got I'm not stupid. My therapist told me to stop saying that out loud on podcasts. He was very specific. I knee-jerk reaction. I just put something ridiculous up on Twitter, taking the mickey out of it, and my agent said they're not going to pay you because it was the contract said a positive tweet. Yeah. So I knew that wasn't for me. And I was on Celebrity MasterChef, and you get a pay incentive. So the longer you stay in MasterChef, the more money you get. And I was pregnant and single, and I knew if I got to the third round, I'd make enough money to give myself maternity leave. And so I cooked beautifully, got to the third round, got my maternity leave money, and then I made a sandwich. Why else would you... The studio was so cold. Like, why would you want to stay there? So I went on I'm a Celebrity, and my poor mum, my mum kept this, she bought this big, thick scrapbook to keep all my press clippings. There was no press about me. Like, none of my exes could sell a story. A couple of them tried.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but the papers weren't interested. And the only thing they wrote about me was, bless my mum, she said... she found an article and it said Chappical Sandy's bisexual. She goes, this one says you're a bicycle. It's the only clipping she had. She's very sweet. She doesn't even know my brother's going to be gay when my dad dies. Anyway, so I was on the show and look, I was a fish out of water. I was on with some proper reality television people and it was really interesting to be in there because a lot of producers think that if you put a comic... in with really loud people will rise to the challenge. And we're not like that socially. Like, if there's really loud, rambunctious people, we're a bit like, have it. If you want it, have it. So I was really, really quiet. And, like, you couldn't have a conversation in there. If you tried to speak, you know, Amir Khan would... come in and go, what crisp flavours do you love? And I was like, oh, okay, we were having a deep chat about her relationship with her dad, but let's go with the crisps. So I just felt like I was at school again with the sporty kids.
Yeah.
It felt like I was with the, we're going to smash it and, you know, stay strong, all that nonsense. And everyone kept performing. And someone got annoyed with me because... So when you're in there, you've got to make a story that you know that the papers are going to run with. And I just sat telling Stanley Johnson all about Emma Hamilton, literally for about an hour one day. I just performed my Emma Hamilton show, and I thought this will be ITV gold. And everyone was making a massive song and dance about this big spider in the camp, and they're all jumping up and down and screaming. And I just went, I'm not scared of spiders. And I just quietly picked it up and put it away. And then it was just a bit like, we were all doing a bit. You know, they were all, it was a performance. And I'm a dickhead. And I didn't realise. I thought, oh, what's the drama, guys? You're behaving as though you're on television. So I was very glad to be let out. And then you're not allowed to come back to England. You have to... stay there for the duration in a 5-star hotel with your family. Okay. And it was amazing. Me and the kids had an amazing holiday, so I joke that I won. I'm a Celebrity, get me out of here.
Well, you know, it's that is interesting that I think you're right. It's not it's like because it's 24 hours a day as well. Presumably, you know, so to be able to keep that up, you have to be sort of insane. You know, like comedians. There are comedians who are never off, I guess, but not even for that length.
You know, there was the fact that there are cameras on you 24 hours a day from every angle, and you see them. There's a fake rock in front of you, and then like. You'll hear a camera, a person sneeze. And I heard you. And then it took me ages to realise they were fake rocks. Like, oh, my God. I just saw a person scramble across there. And Rebecca Vardy was like, yeah, that's where they're filming us. I was like, is it? So I had no idea. And also, I thought that the birds in the evening was... A recording,
okay.
Like in Madagascar, you know, in the zoo where they put the recording of sounds on. I thought it was that.
Yeah.
And then the producers went, no, Shappy, that's real birds. Oh, my God. Yeah, you know you're in the Australian bush, right? Anyway, so what was I saying? I can't remember what you asked me.
You know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's lovely. No, I think just as a comedian.
No, that's it. So the 24 hours thing, other people in there were saying, I want the public to get to know the real me. And I think as a comic, I can't speak for all of us. I mean, I know I work really hard to bottle the real me. Like the real me came out once at a party and it was game over. Like the real me comes out and it's just horrible. So that fascinated me, and the fact that I want the public to know, and that mentality of I'm not tap dancing, I'm not doing anything, but the public need to know the real me. It was just, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but
also,
really...
if you're thinking that, then it's not the real. You're immediately putting a veil over yourself, and going, "I want the public to see what I want the public to." That I imagine the projection of me would be. It's not the real, because the real me would be everyone just farting and scratching.
Yeah,
their
absolutely. And I was so scared that I'd wake up one day in my hammock with my finger up my nose.
Yeah. That would be the least of my worries.
That was my main worry. That was my main worry. And then there's all this, performative empathy.
Yeah.
Like you'd have to go around in a circle and like say why you're doing this program. I said, well, you know, I'm doing this for, you know, my children. I'm doing this to give 2% of my fee to charity. I'm doing this for whatever reason. And everyone's trying to be as good a person as they can possibly be the entire time. We had to go around and say what our best job was that we had. And someone said boots, I said life model, and then someone went, I'd have to say being a mum. And everyone got up and cuddled her and said, oh babe, that's so beautiful, oh babe. And I was like, oh come on. I don't hate my kids. You've now made me feel like I hate my kids because I said I prefer to stand naked in front of strangers than being with my own children. There's all of that stuff. But
okay. Also, as a comedian, as a writer, maybe, and I tend to shy away from doing anything like that, but maybe you should be jumping in and experiencing it, even if you then the experience is, this is a really awful thing to put myself through. Are you glad you did it in the end? Is it something, or just do you feel ambivalent about it as well?
I bought a house by the seaside.
Yeah.
Is that all right to say?
Yeah.
That's why I did it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
If anyone would like to stay at my house by the seaside, you're very welcome to alleviate my guilt.
It's good money.
It's a very small house. It's a shoe.
Oh, look, it's really lovely to see you. And it's very, all this is very fascinating. My watch tells me to go to sleep at 10 o'clock. It's just done it again. I know it's 10 o'clock. It's do-do-do.
Oh, gosh, it's talking to you.
Bedtime reminder. Your bedtime is set for 2200.
I shouldn't have had a drink before I talked to you. I was so determined to do this sober. But then someone offered me one.
Yeah, then it was the drinks. It's fine.
And I'm so old now, I get drunk on half a glass.
Believe me, we've had people on who have been a lot drunker than this. So I wouldn't even count this as being tiddly.
This is lovely, though. I love this. Is like being on the mothership, this podcast, isn't it?
Is it?
Yes. This is like the original.
Well, one of them, yes, I suppose. It's been going a long time. Well, it's been going a long time. And you almost booked. You're one of the earliest guests, I guess, for 2013. You were September 2013. I've done about a year, I think. When
you did this before anyone. Like, I didn't know what a podcast was. I did a podcast at the Soho Theatre. And I didn't know till afterwards that it was recorded and it was going to be broadcast. I thought it was just a quirky name for a show.
Right.
I thought his show was called Podcast.
Like Michael Eavis, and the one that I haven't been out with Michael Eavis. That's what he didn't realise as well.
Are you wrapping this up now, politely?
We'll stop it. I'm just checking. I think there was something else I wanted to talk to you. Well, we didn't talk about... that's a few things. We didn't talk about... So you're back into running. You're thinking of running the London Marathon next year, I see from your Twitter feed.
I am. So
have you done a marathon before? You've done half marathons?
I've done a couple of half marathons. Yeah. So I did the Ealing half marathon a couple of weeks ago, and I'm still sweating from it, actually. but I love it. So I run like between 5 and 15K a day. And then what I do, I take my dog out for 5K, and then I take her home. This is unnecessary information. I take her home, have a wee, and then and then go back out and do however long I want. It's just time. It's not, I mean, physically, obviously, I can handle it. I'd probably do an amazing time. I'd probably get a world record of running. But it's just the time of training. But I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
I think once you run and you get that running bug, you've got to do it right.
Yeah, I mean, I saw.
Have you done it?
I did it in 2004, I think. When I did.
Did it kill you?
No, I was hoping it would kill me. Mm. I sort of took it on almost as a way to commit suicide.
Yes.
Genuinely, I was quite depressed, and I thought if it kills me, then at least I'll be dead. So, and my mum won't have to feel, she'll feel, oh, it's good, he was doing something nice, rather than you've killed yourself. So that was my thinking as I took it on, but it actually cheers you up, doesn't it? So it makes you feel a bit better.
It's interesting you said, because I took up running when I was at the worst point in my life.
Yeah.
And I ran, and I didn't care if I died. I was exactly the same. I was like, I'm just going to go until my heart explodes, because that's how shit I feel. And then miraculously, it sort of gets all the endorphins going, and then you go, I feel so good. and then it becomes a habit, and then you become one of these insufferable people that go, oh, don't run, just walk. And after a while, your fitness will go up, and your legs will just start running on their own. I never ran either. And you know, it's not to lose weight, it's for your head. I'm one of those cunts,
yeah. It's good. I'm doing weight then. A half marathon's a nice distance. I'm quite looking forward to doing the half marathon. A marathon is hard. But
it's a bit odd.
But
ultra marathons.
Yeah, no, I'm
50
not,
miles.
Yeah, that's
like, what are you running away from?
Because you'll be 50 miles away from it. When you
finish.
Yeah,
there are some bodies in your patio if you're running ultra marathons.
It is. It's one of those things that's addictive, and I think, like, as people who get addicted to things, it's more healthy to be addicted.
And it really helps with my head, with my ADHD head, running, because it helps me. Like, I know if I run in the morning, I have a much better day.
Yeah.
Like, everything goes a lot smoother. Like, I'll have I won't have an altercation with a fellow motorist. Why are they such cunts? I'm so new to driving, and I'm endlessly baffled by people. Is anyone in this audience, what statistically one of you must be, one of those people that if the car in front of you refuses to mow down a pedestrian, do you sit behind them and honk your horn?
It is an annoying thing when that happens. But I guess they haven't seen the pedestrian, but it's still massively impatient. Is it? Oh, you've stopped! Probably for a reason.
I'm going to do this. I absolutely am going to do this. Obviously, I'm going to pick who I have my battles with. But the next time someone does that and they don't look like they have a knife, I'm going to get out of my car and go, are you okay? It's just you beeped. I thought there was an emergency. I'm going to do that. In fact, I might just stop when there isn't a pedestrian to do that bit, and it'll be such an amazing tweet afterwards.
How long have you been driving? You are quite new to driving.
4 years.
4 years, yeah. Yeah.
That's why I can't drive myself to gigs. I can drive to... I live in Ealing. Bracknell's really near. But I'm dragging my elderly father out. And he's so small now, my dad. He can't really see over the steering wheel. He used to be able to, but they get so small.
Is he going to be all right to drive you around the country?
Do you know what I think will end up happening? I think I will drive. Yeah. So I can drive at night as long as I have someone sitting next to me. So I made my poor daughter, she's only 8, come to the End of the Road Festival with me, just so I had someone in the seat next to me. And she could have gone to her mates and had a nice time. And I said, but Vivi, I need someone next to me. And she went, it's 80 miles. You could have just put a teddy bear where I'm sitting. I could have. And I just thought, that's an amazing idea.
We'll take it on Dragon's Den.
Teddy bear wingman.
Yeah.
Wing person.
Well, look, Kissing Emma.
Yes.
Out now.
Yes.
Get it read by Shappy to you personally. It's fantastic.
I have to add, Kissing Emma is aimed at young adults.
I liked it.
Early teens. They really made me take out the filthy sex.
Well, it was quite rude. I thought it was pretty rude. I was going to ask if it was young adult, but I thought this is too rude for young adults.
Can I tell you what happened with my book? Again, because of ADHD, and I've only started taking medication this summer, and this book was commissioned 3 years ago, I don't read emails. There must have been a point where I was told it was for young adults. But I missed that information. So I couldn't understand why with every draft, and people in the literary world are so polite, they'd be like, could you maybe allude to this happening rather than describing it quite so graphically? And that kept on happening. And I was like, who are these puritanical people? And then when the press release came out, it said it was aimed at 12 to 15-year-olds. I wrote an email to the publishers and said, look, I'm really sorry, but I didn't understand the age group that I was aiming at, and I want you to know that there's no way on no planet that I think the original anal sex scene that I wrote was appropriate for 12-year-olds. And again, they're so polite, but this time they just think there's something wrong with me. They're like, oh, it's Chappie, that's fine. It's been lovely to work with you. And you know they're never going to mention anything else.
Well, a couple of the anal sex scenes remain in it. So is that...
That'll be the editor's negligence, not mine.
Katie writes, my wife writes books for kids, and she's not allowed to... having people kissing in them.
I know.
And they're for 9 to 12-year-olds.
I know that
so it's
now.
It's a big step up. I've got to be 12, I get to rip. Fucking hell. Kiss before the anal sex. That's what I said to Catherine Wright. Kiss first, then anal sex. Well, there's that, and there's It Was the 90s.
It Was the 90s, yes.
Which is touring all over, if you can get there, if your dad gets there.
Yes. Do you know, I'm so serious in podcasts. I always really worry, but I'm not serious at my comedy shows. It's so weird. It's so weird to just be such a serious person in
You've been very funny in this
life.
Podcast as well.
Oh, no, I wasn't fishing.
It's okay to be serious too, but you've been very,
very
serious.
Funny.
It's okay to be serious.
They keep asking me to go on Question Time. Yeah. The fuck? Why can I get on Question Time far easier than I can get on, like, a comedy panel show? We'll get her in. She's a very articulate brown person. It's really weird.
Yeah, well, I think, like, I wouldn't do Question Time.
No, why would you? You have other options.
But, well, no, but I would just because I don't think I know enough about stuff to do it.
Mate, I mean, that hasn't stopped me.
Well, I think if they're asking you back, that means you're doing well.
It's not worth it, though. It's not worth the trolling. And then it's like, you do that, and then you get asked to do loads of stuff, and the next thing I know, I'm on, like, you know, Newsnight again.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the fuck? This wasn't the dream. Anyway, on that note, can you just edit this down to, this wasn't the dream?
Should just put that
live streamed.
We can live stream.
Wow, it's so modern. All of this is so modern. We don't have live streaming in our day. We could say whatever we wanted. Have I said anything that might cancel me?
No, but you know, there's people here anyway. The live stream is just some people who can't be bothered to come out. So if you say something, they've still heard it. So it's not like they're going to go, oh, we've all signed a thing that we won't say anything. So it'll be all right. Okay. You haven't said anything too bad.
It's been so nice to talk to you.
It's been lovely.
I've liked the company.
Me too.
I've been on my own all day. Just me and the dog.
Ladies and gentlemen, please give a big round of applause to Chaperac Corsandi.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll be back next week with Phil Wang. And maybe someone else as well. You have been listening to Rahala Stepa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Chaperac Corsandi. The music is by Scant Regard. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. Thank you very much to Chris Evans, not that one, for all the hard work he does and all of his fantastic team at Go Faster Stripe. Thank you very much to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre for having us here. And thank you to Kathy McKeegan for research at Rahalastapa, rahalastapa.com. Always worth a look if you fancy it. It's a Sky Potato, Fuzz, and GoFasterStrike.com production. Go to richardherring.com to find out when more Rahalastapas are being recorded. And go to GoFasterStrike.com/badges to become a monthly badger. Get all kinds of benefits, badges, backstage interviews, loads of other extras, cut price tickets, all sorts of things. You know you want to do it, so you should do it. Go on, do it.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.